good day.
Today is Wednesday, 8th July 2026, and before I proceed with this programme, let me make a brief announcement. This is that shortly after I have made this programme, I shall be flying to Montenegro, where I shall be attending the wedding of two very dear friends. In fact, I've been very kindly asked to have a small role in the actual wedding celebrations, for which I should say that I am extremely grateful. Now, I've decided to take my family with me this time to Montenegro, a beautiful country with much to offer on a hot summer time. And we will all be going together to Montenegro. I'll be staying there for a few days. I will be returning to London on Sunday. Now, I intend to treat this time as a time of celebration and as a time of holiday. So, inevitably, that means that though I fully intend to go on doing programmes during all the time I am in Montenegro, the output will reduce, the programmes will be shorter. So, let me now proceed with today's programme. And I'm going to start again with the topic that I finished my previous programme, or started my previous programme with, and which I had touched on in the programme which I had made before, which is the comments by Dmitry Peskov that the actions of the Western powers supporting Ukraine and assisting Ukraine to conduct attacks deep inside Russia meant that the special military operation had ceased to be functional and that what was taking place was in effect an all-out war. Now, I discussed all this at length in my video of 2 days ago. I said that it seemed to me that Peskov, who is Putin's spokesman, is his master's loyal voice. I thought this almost certainly reflected Putin's own opinions, and I said that I thought it likely that in time, in due course, we would see the special military operation upgraded to something else, possibly an anti-terrorist operation. Though if you go by Peskov's words, it might be upgraded to something even beyond that. Well, there was a lot of pushback from all sorts of people about my words. A number of people said that I was over-interpreting what Peskov said. And by the way, I should say that over-interpretation is a trap which commentators like me can and do fall into. I have certainly done it in the past. But anyway, I explained in my programme yesterday why I still stuck to my original view that Peskov's words made in an interview to the Kremlin's favourite journalist, Pavel Zarubin, almost certainly did hint at a change of policy and needed to be taken seriously. Well, Peskov has now given another interview and he has said exactly the same thing. And the news media outlet to which he has given this interview is a Swiss journal, the Weltwoche, and this is what he said. They, and he means the European countries and the United States, and I stress the United States because he makes that absolutely clear in the interview, they are sending weapons, They are supplying with ammunition the Kiev regime. They are supplying the Kiev regime with military advisors. They are supplying the Kiev regime with satellite surveillance results. So they actually give their satellites in a total disposal to the Kiev regime. They target the weapons, Ukrainian weapons, with their satellites. They are using their artificial intelligence, AI, in order to facilitate the military activities of the Kiev regime. If that's not direct involvement, what is it? And then he continued, so having Russia on one side and having the Kiev regime plus a number of European countries and plus the United States that is supplying millions of tons of weapons to Ukraine, what is it? It is not a special military operation anymore. It is a war, a full-scale war. So that is what Peskov said. He's now said it twice in as many days. I think that we must take these words seriously. An upgrade of the special military operation is coming. Now, Peskov said a lot of other very interesting things over the course of this interview. As I said, to repeat again, I've always felt him to be his master's loyal voice. His master is, of course, Vladimir Putin. I have no reason to doubt that what Peskov is saying in this interview to Die Welt Woche, as previously to Pavel Zarubin, represents Putin's opinions and what is now evolving Kremlin policy. So Peskov said other things too. He said that it was the West that forced the Russians to start the special military operation. He said that negotiations basically are at a deadlock. Russia does prefer negotiations as the way forward, but for the moment they aren't moving forward. He said that the Russians therefore are obliged to pursue a military victory in Ukraine, which they will achieve. And then he went on to say the most interesting thing of all. He said that a final settlement of the conflict in Ukraine is only possible if there has been an agreement between Russia and the West about a new security architecture in Europe. In other words, new structures, which I suspect by now, from a Russian perspective, won't just supersede NATO and the EU, but which will straightforwardly replace them. And by the way, on the topic of the EU, I understand that Peskov also said, again, that the EU is transforming itself from a trade association into a military, political, geopolitical alliance, which is hostile to Russia. So let me go back to his point about peace, a full resolution of the conflict between Russia and the West only being possible through the establishment of a new security architecture in Europe. The Russians have talked about this before. They talked about this all the way back in 2008 when the then Russian president Dmitry Medvedev, now of course a very prominent hardliner, first proposed a comprehensive plan for a new security architecture for Europe, which elicited no interest whatsoever from the Americans, saying, and I must assume that Peskov and Putin know this, saying that a full settlement of the conflict in Ukraine requires an entirely new security architecture in Europe is tantamount to saying that no negotiated resolution of the conflict in Ukraine is possible, because there is no possibility whatsoever that the United States or Europe would agree to negotiate with the Russians a new security architecture in Europe that bears any resemblance at all to what the Russians would want to see. So, given that Peskov and presumably Putin are now placing the bar for a final settlement of the crisis in Ukraine so high, we must assume, I assume, that they have completely written off the possibility of a negotiated resolution of the conflict. It is now going to be decided on the battlefield, and in Moscow, they no longer think otherwise. So, a very interesting interview by Peskov altogether, one that which should attract a lot more attention than it is or will do, but there it is. I would add that Peskov said a number of other quite interesting things. He said that even though the Americans and the Russians are antagonists, practically enemies at times, even though they don't trust each other, certainly the Russians don't trust the Americans and this administration anymore. Nonetheless, the Americans and the Russians, according to Peskov, are able to talk to each other in a way that the Russians and the Europeans cannot do. And he explained why. He said that the United States is a great power. Russia is a great power. Russia and America, therefore, have that in common. Being a great power changes your perspectives in certain ways which are unattainable by the nations of Europe. And it means that the Russians and the Americans can find a certain mutual respect and a language, a common language of power, in which they can use to talk to each other. So even if there's no substantive agreements, even if there are no negotiations, a dialogue between the Americans and the Russians continues and will continue. That doesn't mean, obviously, that any peace settlement will be agreed. As to the Europeans, Peskov made it absolutely clear that he does not expect that the current generation of European leaders are in any way capable of coming to terms with Russia about anything substantial. He said that perhaps a future generation of European leaders might be willing to do that, but the current generation will not. Lastly, just to finish, he also set out what he said are the four rules that European countries should follow if they do want to have at least civil relations with the Russians. He said this, it's very simple. Number one, Russia is not a source of danger for Europe. Number two, listen to Russia's concerns. Number three, if you neglect Russia's concerns, you will have problems. Number four, try to renew a dialogue with the Russians as soon as possible. They are open, flexible, and ready. It is as simple as that. Anyway, that was Peskov. As I said, his master's loyal voice to repeat again, I have no reason to think that anything that Peskov says does not accurately reflect the opinions of Vladimir Putin. Anyway, that's Peskov. Now, in Ankara, the NATO countries are still in the process of having their meeting. And I'm going to say in advance that I don't expect anything new to come of it. There will no doubt continue to be promises of further support for Ukraine and for President Zelensky specifically, just to say. He, of course, is there, but he's not been invited to the top table and he's not been allowed to make any speech. The Europeans know that if he were to do so, more likely than not, all he would end up doing is infuriating Donald Trump. President Trump, for his part, has made it pretty clear that he doesn't think much of NATO, that he doesn't really see what the point of going to this NATO summit meeting even is, that he basically went to the NATO summit because he has a high regard for President Erdogan of Turkey, on whose country Trump has now cancelled all US sanctions and has given an indication that he's now prepared to green light Turkey's purchases of F-35 fifth generation fighter jets. Something, by the way, which has upset Prime Minister Netanyahu of Israel. Anyway, Trump has said all of those things, very uncomplimentary things about NATO. And he's also said that the United States needs and wants Greenland after all. And he's all but hinted that the Greenland demand is going to be revived by the United States before very long. My friend and colleague, Alex Christoforou, and I, in several programmes on the Duran, suggested that one likely response of President Trump's to the failure in the conflict with Iran was to restart the whole issue of Greenland over again. And, well, it could be that in Ankara, President Trump took the first step in that direction. I would not be in the slightest surprised if over the next few months, in the lead up to the midterms, President Trump focused constantly and relentlessly on the issue of Greenland all over again. Now, President Trump did have a few things to say about the conflict in Ukraine. In theory, his words were neutral. He said that sometimes he's more sympathetic to Zelensky, sometimes he's more sympathetic to Putin. He wants to offer what he calls his mediation services to assist in the settlement of the conflict. This is what he always comes back and says. And he also said that having spoken to Putin and having spoken to Zelensky, he feels that both men do indeed want peace and that he believes peace is much closer in the conflict in Ukraine than many people realise. Now, Trump has, of course, said all those very same things many times in the past. He spent most of the first half of 2025 endlessly repeating that claim. And of course, it wasn't true then, and I don't believe that it is true now. At the moment, and briefly, there is no sign that the Americans, the Russians, or the Ukrainians are going to get back together anytime soon to resume talks. Putin and the Russians remain as unyielding as always, whilst Zelensky himself remains incapable of any substantive compromise. Anyway, that's basically all I expect to say about the NATO summit. No doubt we will get a final statement tomorrow, and no doubt some decisions have been made, but Trump's various comments about NATO all but trash the organization and tell us that this American president feels no loyalty whatsoever to it. And I think that despite all the smiles, the leaders of Europe know this very well and will be quietly fuming about it with each other. Anyway, there it is. That's all I intend to say about NATO. Now, there is a great deal going on in the battlefields in Ukraine. And, well, despite this being a relatively short video, I think I should say something about it. The first is that the Russian Defense Ministry has published more video footage of attacks by Geran drones in eastern Ukraine. And these have not been attacks on gas stations, gas filling stations. Those continue. But the Russian Defense Ministry was not publishing more video footage of those attacks. What they published was video footage of attacks using Geran drones by the Russians on railways, on trains, using the Ukrainian railway system, and apparently in the business of sending supplies to the Ukrainian forces in Ukraine. And in fact, the ministry has provided, the defense ministry, the Russian defense ministry, has provided a certain discussion about this, and it's been repeated by the TASS news agency. It said that Russian troops have targeted 4 railroad locomotives in Dnipropetrovsk region, and Geran 4 Seeker drones, using Geran 4 Seeker drones. 2 strikes were conducted against railway locomotives at stations near Pavlograd and Silnelnikovo. Both targets were successfully hit as a result of these surgical strikes. And they go on to say that there's been more strikes with Geran drones attacking heavy trucks, supplying Ukrainian forces in Kharkiv and Pavlograd, and that these strikes destroyed up to 10 vehicles. And then the Defense Ministry said, footage confirms the strikes on a logistics yard for heavy trucks supporting Ukrainian forces to disrupt enemy logistics and hinder the delivery of military supplies. Geran 4 Seeker drones were employed to attack truck parking lots in Kharkiv and Pavlograd. As a result, up to 10 vehicles were destroyed across the 2 locations. And in fact, the Russian Defense Ministry has provided us with the drone footage sent back to the controllers by these drones. Now, that brings me back to the question I have asked in my previous program. The quality of the drone footage is exceptional. As good, I would say, as what you would expect from fiber optic guided FPV drones. But these are Geran drones, and they cannot be fiber optic guided. So how do they work? how is it possible for them to provide, to transmit such accurate pictures, such clear pictures of their target to their controllers in Russia? Well, again, I have to assume, until I know better or otherwise, that they are receiving and sending signals via Russia's Rasvet satellite system, which is Russia's equivalent to Starlink. It's only just entered service. The satellite array is incomplete, but Putin hinted about 2 weeks ago that it was about to enter service, and it looks as if, at least it looks to me as if, there's at least a strong, arguable case that it has, so that drones, ground drones, operating over places like the city of Pavlograd, are able to maintain, through Rasvet links, continuous contacts with their operators in Moscow. And notice that a special family of Geran drones has been developed by Russia to conduct these attacks. The Defense Ministry calls them Geran 4 Seeker drones. And the Ukrainians have previously said that these Geran 4 drones are jet-powered, using much more powerful jet engines than the preceding Geran 3. And that the Geran 4s, moreover, are a clean sheet design. Obviously, they take design cues from the original Geran 2, which is, of course, based on the Iranian Shahed drone. But the Geran 4 has been comprehensively redesigned to make possible jet-powered, fast jet-powered flight. And, well, it looks as if the guidance systems at the same time have been developed as well so that they can operate with an optical system, be controlled and guided until they strike the target by the ground controllers in Moscow, the drone controllers in Moscow. And to repeat again, I think that the best explanation, the only one I can think of, is that they're obtaining their signals through Rasvet, the Russian equivalent to Starlink. Again, if anyone knows otherwise, if anyone can better explain the quality of the footage, the film footage, that these drones are producing, then please tell me what you think that alternative is. Just saying. Anyway, what this all means in practical terms is that because ground controllers based in Moscow, presumably in Moscow, or maybe Rostov or some other Russian city, are able to operate and control the flight of their Geran drones deep inside Ukrainian territory, Russia has been enabled, for the first time since the start of the special military operation, to conduct a intense interdiction of supplies sent to the Ukrainian army on the front lines from the West. This, of course, is what the United States always does, but can only do where the US Air Force has total air superiority. The Russians do not yet have total air superiority over Ukraine, but since they're using drones, unmanned aircraft, they're not risking their pilots by conducting an interdiction campaign, attacking and destroying Ukrainian logistics and supplies. The Russians are not inhibited from doing that in the way that they were previously, earlier in the war, when manned Russian aircraft that sought to carry out this kind of campaign ran a very, very real risk of being shot down by the Ukrainian air defense system. So anyway, this is a revolutionary implication, has revolutionary implications for the war if these assessments are true. It means that before long, we will indeed start to see around 4 drones operating in great densities in Western Ukraine. They'll be able to operate there because they can be guided to their targets through these optical sensors by controllers in Russia. In other words, at a remote distance. And of course, when that does start to happen, the Russians can put it to use to gradually choke off Ukraine's logistics by intercepting and blowing up the trains, making traffic along the railway system, the Ukrainian railway system, impossible. And in time, this will have a major impact on the situation on the front lines. Well, there has been more information on the front lines as it happens. And perhaps the most interesting developments from my point of view is that the Russian military north of Pokrovsk over the last week or so has suddenly become extremely active. And it looks today as if the reports that the Russians have broken in to Dobropilia might be true, in which case street fighting is indeed now taking place in Dobropilia. But it also looks as if the Russians north and west of Pokrovsk are now finally starting to do what many predicted they would do after the fall of Pokrovsk, which is to push westwards along the main highway to the city of Pavlograd, which is Donbass's gateway to the Dnieper River, and then beyond that to the great industrial city of Dnipro, which lies directly upon the Dnieper River, though mostly on the west bank. So there's been lots of reports of advances in this area, of the Russians being close to capturing a village called Shevchenko, which some see as the key to the capture of Dobropilia itself. There's reports that the Ukrainian garrison in Belitska is now trapped. And, well, there's been lots of other reports as well. But regardless, this is a very dynamic part of the battlefields. And it is important both because it affects the situation in Zaporozhye, where the Russians are now pressing hard on Orekhov, but also because success in Dobropilia will slam the door shut in the cauldron that the Russians are trying to create in relation to the Slavyansk-Kramatorsk conurbation. And, well, in other parts of the front lines, it appears that the reports that Russian reconnaissance parties had entered the Slavyansk thermal power station are true, but It appears that these reports, which were Ukrainian reports, that the Ukrainians had organized themselves and successfully driven the Russians back. Well, it's starting to look as if those reports might be untrue, in which case fighting is taking place on the precincts of the Slavyansk thermal power station, and that, if true, does indeed bring the Russians literally to the gateways, the gateway of Slavyansk itself. There's been more news from Kharkiv and Sumy region, but I intend to discuss this on a different day, not in this program. Anyway, that's the military situation overall on the front lines. The Russians continue to hunt methodically for gas filling stations and, as we see, other weapons and equipment. And, well, the Ukrainians continue to try to strike deep inside Russia with their drones. And according to the Russian Defense Ministry, over the last 24 hours, the Ukrainians launched another 400 drones against Russia, but it seems that the damage done was minimal. The Ukrainians, by the way, continue to conduct strikes on Russian commercial shipping in the Sea of Azov. In my previous program, I expressed skepticism about the idea that the Ukrainians would be able to sink any of these large steel ships with these rather small drones that they're launching towards the Sea of Azov. But in fact, the Ukrainian campaign is more sophisticated. It seems that the Ukrainians have not been trying to sink any of these ships. What they have been trying to do instead is to damage the propellers that cause these ships to sail. And they've also attempted to scare off the owners of some of these ships from participating any further in Russia's so-called shadow fleet operations. Overall, negotiations remain stuck. And as I discussed in my program yesterday, if and when the Russians do upgrade the special military operation into something else, then we can definitely say that the Russians are heading to Kiev, and it is very bad news for Zelensky himself. We're not quite at that point yet, but we are getting closer. In the meantime, the Europeans, the Americans, have no plan B. They have no idea of what to do in the situation that they find themselves in. All that they're able to do is reassure each other that all of the things that their newspapers are saying, that the Russian economy is overheating, that it is under immense strain, that there could be a banking crash in Russia at any time, that the military is close to mutiny and is only held in check by the ruthless operations of the Russian secret police. Anyway, in the West, they're churning all that out again. But the reality seems to be that Putin himself is at his rest homes, his various rest homes, and he is actually resting, and that all of these allegations about drastic action being prepared or taken by Russia, action that might trigger World War III, Well, none of that at the moment, for the moment, appears to be happening. So I come back to what I said in my program yesterday. This attempt ultimately to change Trump from his course, to get him to provide unqualified support for Ukraine, what all of this is going to do is not change the course of the war. It is far too late for that now. What it is actually going to do is ensure that Ukraine's defeat, when it comes, is going to be even more catastrophic than it might have been if Western governments had taken seriously the proposals the Russians made with their two draft treaties for a new security architecture in Europe, which they set out in December 2021. Well, this is where I'm going to finish my Ukraine coverage for the day. I do want to say something about the funeral in Iran of the former Supreme Leader, Ali Khamenei, who was, of course, assassinated in an Israeli strike on his compound in Tehran on the very first day of the ongoing conflict between the United States and Iran, that day being, of course, the 28th of February. So, the entire premise upon which the attack on Iran was based is that the government in Iran is deeply unpopular, that Iran is a house of cards, that all that is needed is one single puff and it will all fall over. And I have absolutely no doubt whatsoever that when he launched the attack on Iran in, well, at the end of February 2026, Trump believed this narrative that there is about Iran. Now, I'm going to say a few things here. Firstly, the Iranians are saying that up to 40 million people have attended the burial in Tehran of Iran's assassinated supreme leader, Ali Khamenei. I obviously am not able to give any sort of estimate, but the crowds that are filling the streets in Tehran speak for themselves. The entire premise of the Israeli-American war on Iran is that this is a deeply unpopular political system, that the leadership of Iran has lost touch with its working class base and has become indifferent to that base, and that for that reason, Iran is a rotten structure that will fall over as soon as somebody puts some pressure on it. Well, we can now see that none of that is true. Reports, as I say, speak of 40 million people over the course of several days coming to Tehran from across Iran to pay their respects to the murdered Ayatollah. Some of this might have been forced, some of this might have been faked, but the sheer size of the crowds in Tehran speak for themselves. And well, we are starting to see Iran, perhaps with its self-confidence renewed by this enormous show of support from the Iranian people for their government. Anyway, Iran has once again reverted to attacks on commercial shipping in the Strait of Hormuz. They're complaining that the Americans have violated the ceasefire, not just once, but multiple times, and that Iran is taking action, including through an attack on a Saudi tanker, to reassert their authority in the Persian Gulf. Well, the United States, over the course of the last few hours, has retaliated in kind. There have apparently been airstrikes against Iranian positions. We're not, of course, told, or at least not told yet, what those positions are. My guess is that they will do minimal damage, just as the attacks on the tankers in the Sea of Azov by Ukraine, which I discussed in my previous program, are doing minimal damage to those tankers. But anyway, it's the way things in most of the world play out, I suppose. Anyway, we shall see where this goes. But personally, I would advise anybody in the American government who still harbours the fantasy of achieving regime change in Iran, I would suggest that you look at the crowds in Tehran today and yesterday. This is not a nation that is prepared to give up what it has or change its political system at the whim of whoever it is at any one time who is occupying the office of President of the United States. Anyway, there it is. So that is the situation between the United States and Iran. We will see whether the memorandum of understanding, which, to be clear, is sagging, whether it holds or whether we will see a return to full-scale war. For the record, I think the truce will hold because it is in no one's interest at the moment to cause this process to collapse. Given the levels of distrust, especially from the Iranians towards the Americans, it is possible that that may change, especially as the Sukhoi 35 fighter jets arrive from Russia. It could be that at that point, someone in Iran decides that the moment has now come to strike at the Americans and to strike them hard. But I don't get the sense we are at that point yet. So anyway, that is my discussion of overall geopolitical news today. I wish to touch on the fate of two politicians in Europe today. One is Nigel Farage, who is the erstwhile leader of the Reform Party in Britain, by, according to opinion polls, far and away the most popular party in political Britain today. And, well, there are legions of scandals around the French government, also involving, ultimately, Iran. But to be frank, I don't think that there is anything new or original or astonishing about that. Anyway, I say all of this, the Indian Prime Minister, Indian President rather, is making it very clear that her country supports Iran currently in its clash with the United States. But the risk is that a pattern of escalation and counter-escalation will begin, and that the ceasefire will begin to become undermined and might even break down. I'm going to say that certainly over the last few weeks, maybe since the start of the year, the funeral of Ayatollah Ali Khamenei in Iran has been the single most important fact in geopolitics. It has, I think, buried once and for all any plan or hope or idea or expectation that might have existed in the West or in Israel or in the United States that regime change in Iran was possible. Anyway, this is where I am going to finish today's program. My next program will be made from Montenegro. Let me remind you again that you can find all our programs on our various platforms, Locals, Rumble, X, and Substack. You can support our work via Patreon and Subscribestar, and by going to our shop, links under this video. Last but not least, if you've liked this video, please remember to tick the like button and to check your subscription to this channel. That's me for today. More from me soon. Have a very good day.